wintry flavour with rain, hail, sleet and snow. So really feeling quite cold and miserable, I'm afraid. Expect the potential for another 10 centimetres of snow to higher ground in the Western Highlands. Top temperatures 6 to 7 Celsius. As for the weekend, staying wet and windy in the north on Saturday, largely dry elsewhere with winds swinging round to a southerly and continuing to feel warm with highs of 15 Celsius. Rain will ease in the north to showers for Sunday, staying dry and warm elsewhere, and high pressure will keep conditions fine and dry through next week with plenty of daytime sunshine but possible nighttime frost. That's your forecast.
Many thanks, Louise. Now, our book of the week. Peter Firth reads from James Wood's collection, The Fun Stuff. Today, contemplating the work of Ian McEwan.
In different ways, most of Ian McEwan's novels and stories are about trauma and contingency, and he is now best known as the great contemporary stager of traumatic contingency as it strikes ordinary lives. In The Child in Time, a child goes missing at a supermarket and Stephen and Julie's domestic existence is shattered. In Enduring Love, Clarissa and Joe witness the death of John Logan as he falls from a balloon and spend the rest of the novel trying to absorb the consequences. In The Innocent, set in Berlin in the mid-1950s, Leonard Marnham, a telephone communications specialist, is having a passionate affair with Maria, but their relationship cannot survive the experience of their murder of Maria's husband and the subsequent dismemberment of his body in her apartment. The central protagonists of Atonement have their lives ruined by the traumatic, wrongful arrest of Robbie on charges of rape, while the young, just-married couple in On Chesil Beach do not survive the trauma of their honeymoon night. Trauma, in McEwan's work, inaugurates a loss of innocence. After the mother's death, the childhood garden is cemented over in his first novel, and the orphan children set about creating their own corrupted version of childhood. The narrator of Enduring Love returns to the field where John Logan fell from the balloon and thinks, "I could not quite imagine a route back into that innocence." His novels often circle around the idea that a witness trauma becomes a corrupting secret whose possession expels one from a community. This is the case with Stephen Lewis, nursing his obsessive grief for his lost daughter, with Leonard Marnham, and with Bryony in Atonement, of whom McEwan writes that she felt she lacked secrets and could not have an interesting life without them. The distortion of a text, says Freud in Moses and Monotheism, is not unlike a murder. The difficulty lies not in the execution of the deed, but in doing away with the traces. McEwan's novels follow the traces that trauma makes and are often smart, in a Freudian way, about how difficult it is to do away with them. The children in the cement garden cover the corpse of their mother with cement, but botch the job, so that the house begins to smell of her decay and their guilt. These books may be about secrets, but they are themselves highly secretive. McEwan is addicted to the withholding of narrative information, the hoarding of surprises, the deferral of revelations. This manipulation, apart from the obvious desire to keep the reader reading, seems to incarnate a desire to repeat the texture of the originating trauma, and in doing so, to master and contain it. This manipulation of surprise is reproduced at the level of McEwan's sentences. He writes excellent prose, but is fond of a kind of thrillerish defamiliarization in which he lulls the reader into thinking one thing while preparing something else. In The Innocent, Leonard and Maria are having sex in her bedroom. He hears her whispering and thinks it is an endearment. This continues for two paragraphs, and then McEwan reveals the content of the whisper. What at last he heard her say was, "There's someone in the wardrobe." In Enduring Love, Joe thinks he glimpses Jed Parry, his stalker, in the London library. He goes home, makes himself a drink, and hears a creak. "There was someone at my back. It is his wife," and so on. The middle section of Atonement systematically employs this kind of negative estrangement. Two apparently hostile French brothers approach the English soldiers. One is holding something long and rifle-like in his hand. It is a baguette. Later, after the Germans have started bombing the English forces, Robbie Turner sees, across a field, just the heads of his two fellow soldiers resting on the soil. McEwen doesn't need to say what we are thinking, that they have been decapitated. As Robbie approaches, he sees that they are knee-deep in a grave they are digging for a French boy. McEwen probably gets some of this from writers like Tolstoy and Stephen Crane. Tolstoy, after all, was praised for his talent at defamiliarization. Nikolai Rostov stands on a wooden bridge in the heat of battle, and there is a sound as if someone has spilled nuts. A man has fallen down beside him. But Tolstoy's estrangements are for moral correction or readjustment. They open up a new vein of sympathy. McEwen's, more often than not, are visual surprises designed to keep the reader in his expert grip and to keep meaning under control. They do not open up but close off. They are secrets, not mysteries. Graham Greene and George Orwell may have been closer models for McEwen. And behind Orwell and McEwen stands a Victorian manipulator like Wilkie Collins. There is the celebrated visual surprise, for instance, when Walter Hartwright sees Marion Halcombe from behind in The Woman in White. She seems to have a fine figure, a comely shape, until she turns. She left the window and I said to myself, the lady is dark. She moves forward a few inches and I said to myself, the lady is young. She approached nearer and I said to myself, with a sense of surprise words fail me to express, the lady is ugly. In a recent profile in The New Yorker, McEwen said he wants to incite a naked hunger in readers. Tastes differ, no doubt. I dislike strong narrative manipulation and try deliberately to spoil plot surprises in my reviews. McEwen's surprises work, I suppose. They retain our narrative hunger, but surely at a cost. His addiction to secrecy has a way of cheaply playing us, and if his withholdings ultimately seek to contain trauma, they also have the effect of reproducing the textures of the traumas that are his big subjects. I don't mean that his books traumatize us. That would be unfair. Just that we finish them a little guilty, having been exiled from our own version of innocence by a cunning authorial manipulator. For McEwen, I suspect, a story is a long string or fuse of heaped improbabilities, and he delights in the way that retrospectively all these improbabilities have been neatly made sense of. That we are forced to say to ourselves, it could not have been any other way. Leonard Markham in The Innocent reflects on the fact that his engagement party became a fight, then a murder, then a bloody sawing up of body parts, thinking how all along the way each successive step had seemed logical enough, consistent with the one before, and how no one was to blame. There is nothing accidental, it seems, about these highly strung narratives, which in fact attempt to contain and hold accident. One of Bryony's crimes in Atonement seems to be not that she acts like a bad novelist, but just that she acts like a novelist at all, imposing form and plot on a story that, properly pursued, would be limitless. Stories, she reflects, are stories only when they have endings. Only when a story was finished, all fates resolved, and the whole matter sealed off at both ends so it resembled, at least in this one respect, every other finished story in the world, could she feel immune and ready to punch holes in the margins, bind the chapters with pieces of string, paint or draw the cover, and take the finished work to show her mother or her father when he was home. There has to be a story about Robbie, she thinks. And this was the story of a man whom everybody liked, but about whom the heroine always had her doubts, and finally she was able to reveal that he was the incarnation of evil. She could never forgive Robbie his disgusting mind. Bryony imposes a plot. She makes what she has witnessed mean something. This is just what Henry Perrone, in Saturday, dislikes about the fiction his daughter gets him to read. On the one hand, he thinks, fiction is a clumsy, pointless provider of information more efficiently gathered elsewhere, and on the other hand, it is too tidy. Unlike in Daisy's novels, he thinks, moments of precise reckoning are rare in real life. Questions of misinterpretation are not often resolved, nor do they remain pressingly unresolved. They simply fade. Another difficulty with McEwen's manipulations is that he seems to want to have it both ways, at once decrying too much pattern and making use of too much pattern. It is all very well for Henry Perrone to object to the fakery of turning points in fiction, but he is embedded in a book devoted to such mechanisms. Atonement prosecutes Bryony, and by extension a certain kind of fiction, for a compulsive need to tidy up life's limitless messiness with plot, to make loose endings too neat. But Atonement is of course itself a very tidy novel. And yet, Atonement is also a moving and ample story, in a category apart from McEwan's earlier fiction. How does it work? Partly, its multi-sectioned form allows a little air into McEwan's usual narrative vault. In particular, the first section, set in a country house in 1935, is a brilliant feat of storytelling, whereby McEwan manages to sound both like McEwan and not quite like himself. He must sound a bit more ornate and experimental than usual, so that the section can plausibly be revealed later on to have been written by the Virginia Woolf-loving Bryony Tallis. Yet he must also please his readers, who want his usual effects, tight plotting, dark secrets, turning points. Martin Amis is right to consider this long passage McEwan's best piece of writing. Simply at a technical level, it is astonishing to be able to write so well at a slight angle or distance from one's own voice, and yet continue to give readers what they want. And indeed, knowing what readers want is at the heart of the diabolical success of this book. What is especially interesting about it is the delicate way it makes readers aware of their own desire to be gratified by serious narrative manipulation. In the fourth section of the book, set in 1999, Bryony Tallis is an old and eminent writer who has just been given a diagnosis of dementia. The novel ends with her at her desk, reflecting on the piece of writing she first started in January 1940 and to which she has returned half a dozen different times between then and now. But although we now comprehend that what we have just read, the text of the entire novel, was written by Bryony, we have no great desire to comprehend that what we have just read was made up, that is, invented by Bryony. McEwan plays on the tendency for readers to turn fiction into fact. If we have just read in section 3 that Bryony walked to Clapham and saw Robbie and Cecilia there, this must have really happened, yes? On the last two pages of the novel, of course, McEwan lays bare his final secret. It seems Robbie died at Dunkirk in June 1940, and Cecilia was killed in the same year by a bomb in Balham. The lovers never united. Bryony invented their happiness as an act of novelistic atonement. Plenty of readers are irritated by this conjuring trick, but perhaps they should go easy on their disdain, because if Bryony made it all up, so did they. If the desperation of both her guilt and her wish fulfillment stirs us, it is because we have ourselves conspired in it, not just content, but eager to believe, until the very last moment, that Cecilia and Robbie did not actually die. We wanted them to be alive, and the knowledge that we too wanted a happy ending brings on a kind of atonement for the banality of our own literary impulses. This is why the ending provokes interestingly divergent responses. It alienates some conventional readers, who dislike what they feel to be a trick, and it alienates some sophisticated readers who also dislike what they feel to be a trick, and I suspect that the estrangement of both camps has to do with their guilt at having been moved by the novel's conventional romantic power. It shouldn't be possible, but Atonement wants to have it both ways, and almost succeeds in doing so. It prosecutes and defends the very impulses that make McEwan such a compellingly manipulative novelist, and it makes us his guilty co-conspirators.
And in tomorrow's final essay, James Wood packs up his father-in-law's library and considers what our libraries have to say about us. The Fun Stuff is read by Peter Firth, abridged by Eileen Horn, and produced by Clive Brill. It's a Pacificus production for BBC Radio 4. The shipping forecast follows in a minute or so. In the meantime, we're sailing by. BBC Radio 4. Now, the shipping forecast issued by the Met Office on behalf of the Maritime and Coast Guard Agency at 0015 on Friday the 7th of March. There are warnings of gales in Viking, North Utsira, South Utsira, Forties, Cromarty, Forth, Tyne, Dogger, Fisher, German Bight, Humber, Trafalgar, Lundy, Fastnet, Irish Sea, Shannon, Rockall, Melin, Hebrides, Bailey, Fair Isle, Faroes and South East Iceland. The general synopsis at 1800. Low Malin 1007 moving northeast and losing its identity. New low moving rapidly northeast, expected 250 miles northeast of Faroes 974 by 1800 Friday. The area forecasts for the next 24 hours. Viking North Utsira, South Utsira, Forties, Cromarty, Forth. Southerly 5 to 7, occasionally 4 at first, veering westerly or southwesterly 6.